Hello, welcome to LA Lit number 4. We are here at CalArts, recording in the Cube today. LA Lit is an interview show with writers talking about their work, allowing them to read their work and present it in a comfortable environment. LA Lit itself is a show that reflects the literary culture of Los Angeles, whether that means writers who were born here and grown up here and written here throughout their entire lives, or we also interview writers who just happen to be in Los Angeles at the time, contributing to the literary culture of LA. I am your co-host, Matt Timmons.
And I'm Stephanie Ryu. And today we're lucky enough to have with us Doug Kearney.
Happy to be here.
Yeah. Matt and I both went to school with Doug here at California Institute of the Arts. And that's how we met him and know about him. And Doug, tell us a little bit about the books that you have out and the performances that you've done and just a little bit about your history.
Okay. Well, I've done some independent chat books, you know, kind of easy, quick, cheap, go to a copy store type of situation. One's called Anthem Collapsing. Another is called Atomic Buck Dance. What I do have coming out in terms of a major release is Fearsome, which should be out from Red Hen Press sometime in 2006. It's my first full length collection, so I'm very excited about that. I've had the opportunity to perform a lot across the country, as you were saying. I mean, a lot of my performance chops began in San Diego. I had moved there right after undergrad at Howard University, and met a crowd of people there who used to run this writing workshop called Writer's Block, and we had the opportunity to do a lot of performing there. And from there, I moved to Minneapolis, and really dove into the scene there. And one of the best opportunities I've had, well, two of the best opportunities I've had have been in Minneapolis. The first, I got to be part of a four poets that were commissioned to do a performance piece at the Wiseman Art Museum on the Russian avant-garde. And it was really interesting. I mean, you know, we did our kind of version of a multimedia thing. You know, we wore white and had the slides projected onto us as we read. I mean, you know, stuff like that. But what was really engaging about it was working with something close to occasion poetry. I mean, like, I've never really been one that's been generally oriented towards writing poetry about something ahead of time to deal with a certain event. And this was, you know, the opening of this exhibition. But it really kind of forced me to think about the work in different ways and sort of formed the base for a lot of ideas I had later on. When you're looking at futurist art and trying to figure out, I don't want to just write about this painting. What is the technique of this painting? And is there a way to do that in writing? And that sort of formed a lot of ideas later on. And then, yeah.
So you'd say you've certainly explored like form and content and the relationship between, of course, right?
Oh yeah. Form and content. I mean, you know, I've had the opportunity to teach a few times, and you know, my students always get irritated whenever I say we're going to talk about form, and they're you know, form. I don't want to learn no forms and everything like that. But I think form is fascinating just because it comes with two things, and I said two things before about something else, but it comes with two things. One is an expectation of the content. You know, if you have a sonnet, you know, people understand, oh, well, sonnets are supposed to be about love, you know, at some point. But then also form, I think the best forms are designed to sort of simulate an intellectual moment. And so when you understand that, you know, when you understand that haiku in many ways is about recognizing as something that's occurring in nature and then having a sudden realization about that, you understand why it's so short, why you have to have certain things happening in a haiku. And when you have that kind of understanding, then you understand how to create certain responses in readers that you can do. So,
sure.
Yeah, form and content are very important to me.
And I think also tying into performance, one of the first things that I saw when I came to CalArts was your performance at Blue Note.
Remember that?
Really was an eye-opener for me, who had been sitting in her little bat cave writing poems all alone. And And then after that, you know, I was sort of initiated into this whole world, and that leads me to these projects you're doing with the libretti, which I'm hoping that you would tell us about.
Oh, yeah. Well, I really became interested in the idea of working with opera very soon after seeing one. I'm not going to name the opera because I'm going to critique the opera. But I found it to be difficult to follow. And the main reason that I fixated upon was the surtitling, which is relatively new in opera. You used to, if you didn't know the language, you just kind of sat there and said, okay, I'll let it wash over me. But the surtitling, you're able to control the speed at which you're reading the translation. Yet the singing, especially in an aria, is protract. I mean, it's just like, you know, it's like 1 minute on one syllable. Huh. So I had this huge disconnect between the text that I was reading and the text as it was being performed. Well, this really connected to, I saw this in the last semester of my first year at CalArts. And it really connected to my ideas of tension between written and an oral word. And so that, I said, well, opera then. You know, here's this opportunity to have a text that people are going to be reading this text at the same time they're hearing this text performed. Mm-hmm. Before that, I'd been engaged with the idea of multiple voices. You know, as soon as I realized after my first few years really writing spoken word, which is first very dogmatic and very, this is what we do, this is how you are to do it, and if you do it this way, everything will be fine. You know, very, you know, rhetorical. I really got into this idea of, like, it's interesting to not know what you're supposed to do. And I started writing these poems where instead of completely moving into sort of ambiguity or ambivalence, I would actually have these very dogmatic voices just clashing in the same space. And so I wrote a couple of poems. The poem Atomic Buckdance, which I mentioned having a chapbook out of, which will also, the poem will also appear in Fearsome, is one of those poems where it's just sort of this argument between, you know, several different characters. One of the poems that you heard at Blueprint was Quantum Spit, which uses the same sort of principle of having these different sort of voices, you know, clearly delineated, not only typographically, but in the beginning of the poem, there's like a little note that says, this voice represents the two-head, this voice represents mm-hmm. the singer, you know, in the case of Atomic Buckdance. And really getting a chance to see that play out. Well, the libretto seemed to me to be a perfect way of sort of continuing and formalizing that, where I was going to not only then have the opportunity to have these multiple voices clashing on stage, I was also going to have this opportunity to have text being sort of played while they're performing, but I was also going to have this whole other dynamic of music and visuals that I could use to do some of the things I was trying to do typographically. I could now communicate musically or visually, because it would be a drag to have to write everything that you're trying to do. You don't want to you don't want to turn the poem into an instruction manual. You want people to be able to get certain things from it, so you can figure out ways to work the poem visually, even to kind of create an idea.
Well, and also I have to say that I mean, you not only did you do all that, you also created an entire language within that word.
Yes, and, good point.
And actually really created a language. It wasn't, because some people make these kind of faux languages, but this was a true language with a syntax, and mm-hmm. without going into the whole story of how you created it, maybe, but it was another element of the form, content, whatever.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about the language created.
Well, the language, as I designed it, it was influenced by patois, crypt talk, you know, sort of mimetic, the Das Effects, bum, stickety, bum hunt, you know, those kind of the iggity mimetics. Mm. Things from the slang from the Harlem Renaissance and stuff like that. So basically, the process is this. This is how I would say the process. I would write something in English, and I would look at it. That was step one, write something in English. Step two was figure out, using this sort of repository of different vernaculars, different grammatic patterns, how could I re-say that in as many different ways as possible? Mm-hmm. And then what was the most interesting step for me, which had applications beyond that opera, was then figuring out sort of idiolectically how I was going to take what I had with all of these, you know, 15 different ways to say, I don't know. How was I going to take that and sort of process it and turn it into this final stage? And then syntactically, you know, as the vocabulary began to build, what became the most fascinating part of it was when the vocabulary began to build, the etymology for new vocabulary no longer had to go to the slang, to the kind of the bank of slang I had. It could now begin to be self-referential and could now feed off of itself within the context of the invented language, the Ngombo. And
I've forgotten. What do you name it now?
It's called Ngombo.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. And so it was just, I mean, like, the crazy things. Like, you're sitting there going, okay, what sort of slang exists for of? I mean, the word of. I mean, so you suddenly have to think, okay, well, what is of? And now you're really thinking at a level of what I like to call poetic attention that I've never been before, because everything that I put down was a huge decision. You know, to me, it would be a cop-out to just sort of write something phonetically, like of would be UV. I mean, that to me was a cop-out.
Yeah.
So, like, I had to think, okay, well, what is of? And then you can't just plug of in every single time you think that of is going to appear, because of has different senses, and now you have to honor those different senses.
Sure.
As I go through the process of rewriting that opera, because it's not ready, and as I go through the process of refining the language even further, it's now figuring out, okay, well, what sort of idioms exist in Ngombo that, instead of being a letter-for-letter, word-for-word translation, where can 15 lines of English be said in 8 lines of Ngombo through some idiom that exists in Ngombo, you know?
Well, and also, I mean, as you're talking about how you've created this language, even there, you're pulling from multiple voices again.
Right,
I mean,
certainly.
The multiple voice, kind of this weave of voices, is embedded in the words you're using.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I mean, you took it to a nice point there, I'd say.
Thank you.
Also, it seems to me that project is very much center stage in this book, Fearsome.
Oh.
At least it was for me. And so we should just jump into a poem, I think, before we keep asking a bunch of questions. I think we decided to start with Poem with Some Sand.
Oh, okay.
And All at Once, Shaitan.
Okay.
Usually
when I've read this before, I do some contextualization. Would it be better to do that after? You prefer after?
Or? Oh, if you want to, yeah, contextualize, please.
Okay. Well, this poem was written in sort of a response to California, Southern California in particular, its sort of shape-shifting qualities. Here in Valencia, you can go to housing developments that are modeled after Cape Cod or places like that, which I've always just found fascinating, because people forget that Southern California is essentially a desert. I mean, it's a desert. And so this poem talks about those sort of housing developments. It also talks about the military base at 29 Palms, which is, you know, up past the in the Joshua Tree regions, where one of the reasons why they like to use that is it's a great simulation of Iraq and the Middle East in general.
Yeah.
You know, California's Hollywood history has been that you could recreate all these different environments in it. So these poems, this poem speaks to that. And then the final thing is, shaitan is a word that means two different things, at least once again with the twos. it can mean a sandstorm. It can also mean the devil's children sort of running wild on the earth. So this is Poem with Some Sand and All at Once, Shaitan. At the edge of it, you're in the middle of it. The sea steady shushes this. Each shell scalloped over the grits and grains. This is exactly what they said it'd be like over here. The sea whispering behind. You take some home in your shoes. Towel, each shell some shill playing with itself. This is California, but it's California. It's a game after all. You and your bucket. It's a game. Scoop and flip, a parapet, a game of it. On your towel, flipping fortifications of sand, a network of citadels, and the game, you Godzilla, Godzilla, is to destroy it.
At the edge of it, you're in the middle of it. The jet roar tells you this. Each shell scaping the grunts, scalping the grunts and groans. This is exactly what they say it's like over there, the jet roar says. If you go home with yourself in a towel, it's because you didn't listen to the jets. This is California, but it's Iraq. It's a game, after all. You and your musket. It's a game. Aim and fire. A turret, a game of it. On your belly, blasting fortifications of sand. The sand is mined, but not yours. And the game, you god-killer, is to liberate it. At the edge of it, you're in the middle of it. The brochures hate this. Each shell scaping the grottos and grades. This is exactly what they say it's like living over there. The brochure winks. If you buy a home, you'll come in a towel because it's so good here. Did you see the lake? This is California, but it's Provence. It's a game after all. You and your wallet. It's a game. Tour and buy. An investment. A game of it. On your credit, financing fortifications of sand. The sand is now yours. And the game, you good dealer, is to profit. At the edge of it, you're in the middle of it. The cacti remind you of this. Each shell scaling the grittiest of grains. This is exactly what they say it's like dying over there. The cacti rasp. If you don't know the way, throw in the towel because it's so hot here. You didn't see a lake. This is California, but it's wasteland. It's a game after all. You and your gullet. It's a game. Burn and die. A remnant. A game of it. On your last breath, cursing fortifications of sand. You are now the sands in the game, you God-fearer, is to survive it. Sand is trickly. It's tricky. It is poor counterfeit water. Pour counterfeit water into a glass. It is sand, even the glass, which is clear as water, but is sand. Clear? Sand is trickly. Counterfeit water poured through pores into glass. Which is water? Is it sand, the glass even? Pour water in a clear glass, but is sand clear? Come, pick through the sand, infants and old men. Search for shells, search for coins, all the treasures of your postcard dreams. Say, mine! You there. Be Godzilla. You there. Wash your feet before you get in the car. Say, I love it here. There are bodies everywhere. And drive-thrus. Succulent. Here is a camera, a carbine, a canteen, a carport. At the edge of it, you're in the middle of it. It's just like they say. Sand is tricky. Clear? Shaitan! Sam! Shaitan! Harmatan! Sim! Cam! Shaitan! Come pick through the limbs of infants. Pluck the prickly pairs of toes and fingers, purple as plums. Do you hear a jet? There are bodies everywhere. Bury each in a newspaper and give them to an eagle with eyes plucked. God, it'll be a sight! Something for a scrapbook, a postcard written in crude. Went to the beach and drove to the base of 29 Palms. Saw lovely model homes, then headed toward Death Valley. All in one day. Wish you were here. The Gila monsters are drinking atomic milk, and the cacti have stopped hiding their pistolas. Cats are getting gatted by succulents now. The bullets sizzle in flight, and the sun whispers voodoo. The desert empties its shoes and waits at a broken shower. Dude, is that skateboard made of bone? Whose? What's? May I take your order? A muezzin buzzes. A cow is being offered up. The drive-thru is bulletproof. Your house keys chatter like stowaways in a minivan. The milk-fed Gila monsters are big as camels and come with optional technology nooks and two-way fireplaces. There are bodies everywhere. Say, I love it here! Close your Venetian blinds. There's an old man with his mail-order metal detector. He wants a rare nickel and knows the sand hoards such things. The trickle-down sand, dreaming of springs and hoarding enough nickels to pay the mortgage, to build a lake, to eat a lake. Yes! Give me a lake! Supersize it! The jets roar. The cacti seem to fire all at once. Someone's found a shell in the sand. Say, mine! There is metal all over now. A boy rolls around on hot, bony wheels. Dude, is that? His shoes empty. The monsters grow. The eagle whispers voodoo. The shower breaks.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. We'll be saying thank that you. After every poem. Thank you.
So this poem kind of is slightly like a housing development in that, and I'm sure, you know, I'm sure our listeners caught this, but that the first, you know, the first like four or five sections of it are repeating a model that you set up at the mm-hmm. beginning and change differently to talk about different spaces or places, mm-hmm. Different themes, that kind of thing. Talk to us about that.
Oh yeah. I mean, there's this, I mean, when you go to these housing developments, as you know, you're pointing out beautifully, I mean, they're the same frame. It's just sort of like, okay, well, do you want the kind of clay tile ceiling, or do you prefer your roof, or do you prefer shingles? You know, do you want your driveway on the left or the right? You know, do you want a den, or do you want a third bedroom? Uh-huh. So there was that sense of that kind of building to sort of create this sort of environment within the landscape of the poem. One of the reasons why I like writing longer poems is because you get the opportunity to sort of create a landscape, and then you set the rules for that landscape, and then when you break them, it means something. Mm-hmm. So there's that. And repetition, as people will find if they take a look at my work, is really important to me in that I try not to be, tautological about it. I don't want to just be redundant. I want to represent phrases so that we're forced to unpack them differently each time we receive mm-hmm. them. And then when we reread the work, hopefully people will reread the work, they'll try to see what senses of it exist throughout, what senses of it are isolated in one place. Pun became very important to me early on in when I was dealing with that idea of tension between written and spoken word, because when you hear it, the writer's intonation sort of prescribes how you're going to understand a certain word. When you look at it and hear it in your head, you have to make that decision, which I found very interesting. And when you look at blues, jazz, and hip-hop, especially when you're talking about sampling in mm-hmm. hip-hop, the idea of repeating something, and I'll talk about it a little bit differently when I talk about sampling, the idea of repeating something is a sort of repetition and revision. Every time you say it, there's something that's added to it.
Sure.
So that it isn't just, you know, saying it again. You know, when I change something within that formal structure that you mentioned,
yeah.
it calls attention to itself because it's changed. And that's something that happens a lot in blues and jazz. And with hip hop and sampling, what I really have always been intrigued by about it was the way an artist could take, you know, could have a turntable to scratch in this whole, you know, this chunk of vocal from something else. And suddenly that vocal was participating in the song, yes, mm-hmm. but it still had its own pedigree mm-hmm. of where it was from. So suddenly you're getting this person to co-sign to what you're saying. And then the other thing that really was freaky to me about it was just that it was different in that sample was a sort of a block. It wasn't individual words. That sample was a sort of a plastic phrase. It was boom, there it was. And so to repeat that sample throughout, for example, suddenly you're dealing with a different kind of dialogue because you're not dealing with somebody talking anymore. You're dealing with this sort of block of meaning.
Sure.
And every word that the MC says, every note that's in the production inflects that block of meaning. And I just found that really, really fantastic. And I've just been interested in repetition because of things like that.
Sure.
I mean, that's just what I was going to ask you about, and here you've addressed it already. That's so great. but I was going to ask it mm-hmm. in terms of your imagined reader and your real reader, as yeah. Matt and I are here.
And thank you.
Yes, our pleasure. So how do you perceive that relationship based on this effort of unpacking, which, like, for mm-hmm. example, the line, "the shower breaks,"
mm-hmm.
I mean, mm-hmm. it just shimmers with all kinds of meanings, and it's exciting for me as a poet and a reader,
mm-hmm.
but what about all those other ones that you think about?
Ah, yeah, that's a very good question. Okay, there's a couple of ways I've been thinking about this recently, so I hope I don't sound actually like a couple of ways again. Jeez. There are 18 ways, and I'm going to mention two of them. Ah, oh, jeez.
I believe it, yeah.
Yeah, you know, that I can respond to this. One of the poems we talked about earlier, Quantum Spit, it is full of, I don't want to say games, but structural challenges that I put upon the work that forced me to try different things, that got me out of comfortable spaces. It's modeled in some ways after an essay where you have this sort of introductory paragraph and you work your way through these sort of introductions. There is, in the middle of it, there's a modification of a sestina that's supposed to be a part of a drum solo. And, you know, if you know the form of a sestina, it has these sort of intermittent repetitions of end words called teleitons. And so they come in a set order. But if you isolate, if you take away the sentences in front of them, and if you're not aware of the form, it just looks random. But there is an underlying structure in the way that a lot of people respond, like a drum solo is just sounding like they're just beating random stuff. But no, there is this underlying structure. Now, all of that stuff and more goes into the process. Now, most people aren't going to know that. But what I can say with confidence is if I didn't do that, their experience of the poem would be a completely different experience. You might not know how your car works, mm-hmm. but if they put a screw in the wrong place and the car breaks down when you're driving a certain speed, you understand this was not, you know, this wasn't right. If your car is this fine-tuned machine that when you need it to suddenly jump 10 miles per hour in a moment, you can do it, you're appreciating that even though you don't know everything that went into it. So I do believe that the effort isn't about necessarily everybody getting everything that you're doing. It's about creating this thing that wouldn't exist without that effort. Then the other hope is that you put enough clues, enough cues, and one time I was talking about rewarding the reader and somebody argued that I was sounding sort of patronizing. And I was like, I hope not. I mean, I hope people enjoy reading what you're doing. It's not rewarding as in, oh, you're so wise for reading this poem. But if somebody's sure. going to spend, even if they're not spending money, even if they're just standing in a bookstore, they're spending time looking at line one, you're hoping that there's something in there that makes them want to look to line two. Mm-hmm. And in that sort of system of pleasure, you hope they'll spend enough time with it to start kind of understanding how the poem might be functioning. My wife likes to talk about how, you know, poetry in some ways can tell you how the poet thinks. And so the advantages of a full-length collection is you have the opportunity to really sit there for a while. And you'll begin to notice patterns, I think, among certain poets, certain kinds of turns of phrase. I mean, you know, some people work very hard at leaving no trail. At all of any kind of pattern. But to me, even that, you know, if I want to just be kind of smug and snide, even that is a sort of a pattern. They're going to try to lose you. Not necessarily lose your meaning, but not want to be read. They don't want you to be able to read them. They want to stay veiled. And I'm not arguing that that's negative or anything. But I do think that if a person spends some time with it, I do work to create a kind of writing that will reveal itself. Admittedly, maybe not on the first read, because, you know, you want to create something that echoes and has that resonance. But I think it's there. You know, I think it's there. And, you know, my understanding of the role of critic, some of it is, you know, filling in some of those gaps. I mean, most people don't read, you know, most of the people that you're talking about that, you know, would just be coming to this and aren't necessarily MFA students or English majors or anything sure. like that. They're not necessarily going to read, you know, books of criticism on anybody's work and then read the work, you know. But I think that knowledge base that, you know, kind of filters out and floats around, I enjoy it. And I think that I hope that people, if nothing else, can get a sense of the sort of energy that goes into it. If not, you know, sometimes the energy isn't about my energy isn't always about pleasure, but I try to approach every poem that I certainly try to get published with a measure of energy that I hope people can detect.
Sure.
Yeah.
Which this might not be fair, but the next poem we wanted to hear, Orange Alert, mm-hmm. has a tie-in here, War Bears Litters of Similes.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, I didn't know if it was fair for me to bring up a line of a poem, but that's the next one that we wanted to hear. And it's tied in, I think, of course, with the last one we heard, right. So we wanted to hear them in succession.
Okay. No problem. This is called The Orange Alert, and it's a poem that sort of takes place in Altadena, which is where I grew up. And it's sort of northeast of Los Angeles and right north of Pasadena, right in the foothills. The Orange Alert. Picture the upturned millipede, dead, and see the streets of Altadena. Palm tree rows against the concrete, stiff to the horizon. There have been no birds big enough, we are comforted, to pluck the chitons from before our yards. And vanish into the sun like dog-fighting migs. War bears litters of similes. Altadena, smog hugs the foothills like mustard gas, where our rich peer through their blinds into ravines. Santanas sway the mustard plants. Yucca bobs some man, his cigarette, a full gas can, an itch. We've known the Orange Alert, fires reaching for helicopters like cartoon cats clawing at panicked birds. Yesterday, fire engines and hazmat trucks jostled at Alameda and El Molino. like beetles eating a four-legged spider. That morning, radios warned of orange. Neighborhood kids watched officers climb in and out an open manhole, consulting the entrails of the great dead millipede. We watched the ground, the sun hotter than all year. The mountains hid Santanas. The smog went orange with dusk, the growing shadows of lingering birds.
Okay, so I read this, and this, when I first read this, this poem to me, like, reflected pretty much, like, my first 3 months in California for me, and because I got here right when there were all these fires, right in this neighborhood, and I was thinking, like, I wonder if he wrote this during that time. But of course, you're writing about Altadena, but the crossover between these fires and this kind of dogfighting MiGs, war bears, litters of similes, it seemed to connect in a way to this kind of, you know, the terror alert system. Mm-hmm. When I first read the title of the poem, I thought, oh, here's going to be a nice poem about the terror alert system. You know?
Which breeds so many nice poems, yes.
Yeah. but the kind of state of constant, you know, vigilance, talking about the fire engines like beetles eating a four-legged spider, things like that. So talk to me about like, you know, why this subject for you?
Mm.
Besides the fact that it's like Altadena, it's your home, but
right. The idea of anxiety is central to my work. The book is really organized around those sorts of themes, you know, that there's the anxiety that you feel if we go by sections. Like the first section is sort of the most autobiographical. So, you know, the anxieties that I felt growing up, the anxieties that people might feel for me, mm-hmm. things that make me uncomfortable about myself and might very well make a reader uncomfortable about sitting and reading more of the book. And then we move into more of a kind of a national anxiety, which this poem and the poem before it both come from, you know, once again, you know, an internal and an external anxiety. And then we move into race and we move into aesthetics. And then we end with the really obnoxious poem at the end.
Don't listen to him.
Really
amazing.
So that idea of orange alert, you know, just this sort of thing of like, get ready, you know, this sort of seasonal quality of fear, you know, traditionally, you know, autumn, you know, is the season of fear, you know, like, you know, you have the Halloween coming in. So it's like this sort of expected fear, and living here with fire season. I mean, mm-hmm. it's fire season.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, and just comparing, you know, our relationship to color. I mean, you know, the highest alert is not blue, you know, it's not right. green alert, you know, it's this color that we associate with heat. Colors that we associate with heat, blood, you know, fire, blanching light, you know, an ending of life, you know, like a desert's gold or white and, you know, blanched. It's not blue and, you know, and verdant green and lush.
Yeah.
So living in this place where, and it was one of those moments of really great poetic luck. It was in the newspapers. This is the hottest day of the year, and there were these hazmat trucks there. I mean, every now and then you get that kind of gift of a real thing happening, which I think is a pleasant gift. I don't think you need it. You know, I don't think, I mean, if I invented this, I don't think it, you know, takes away from the poem. But when you actually have that moment, you kind of go, wow, you know, it's the hottest day of the year. See these hazmat people ducking into the sewers as if there might be something down there, you know, and knowing that, you know, they're looking down, but the mountains are these dry scrubs. And what we're used to being concerned about is terror and fire from carelessness, a human flicking a cigarette, or from actual absolute malice, but mm-hmm. not with an ideology. You know, it's not, you know, arsonists that have occurred in California, in Southern California, have rarely been connected to any sort of specific agenda. It's just as often, you know, a dried landscape dealing with a heat. And, you know, humans are in the wrong place, You know, if they're trying not to get burned, their houses burned down, it's a bad place to be. So this idea of like a human threat versus this sort of natural threat, and just dealing with that idea of that anxiety that's constantly happening, and then it gets sort of exacerbated by an alert system.
Yeah, and in this way, I really felt that this, like, this poem, The Orange Alert, was still connected to. All
right.
Connected to, like, what you're doing and talking a little, you know, alluding to Iraq in the Shaitan poem.
Yeah.
Right? And I feel like I felt like there was a few things in here that still connected, because we're talking about a sort of, you know, the paranoia, being always constantly on alert, you know, type of state that creates. So.
Right. No, I hope so. Yes.
And I'm glad you said the blanching light that brings on the apocalypse. Because this is something that I wanted to bring up too regarding African American experience and
African American experiences. If you remember my thesis presentation.
Yes, experiences and back to that multiplicity. Mm-hmm. And this book is just rich with, I mean, I said to Matt earlier, it seems to me to leave no stone unturned.
Oh, excellent.
You know, just every page is like, I'm going to open this one up, and I'm going to open this one up. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's incredible to read. And
thank you.
It's going to be a really amazing first book. Thank you. Just to let the readers know.
Yeah. Yes, please. You heard it. Straight from LA Lit.
Yeah. So I was hoping that you could address that, and also what follows from that are the next poems that we have here lined up. So let's talk about the nitty gritty.
Okay. Well, the African American experiences, once again, now finally we're going to be able to move from twos to at least three. you can start off with two perspectives. The opera Jungai, the one with the invented language, dealt with two sort of archetypal figures. There's the, at one level, at least my attempt was to deal with this idea of the African and the American, two figures that were each supposed to sort of allude to those sort of things, which forms this idea, but echoes this idea W.B. Du Bois put out about the double consciousness. You know, you have the African, the American, and everybody talks about the double consciousness, but I began to think about, well, if you have the African and you have the American, there's this third consciousness that perhaps took, you know, decades to begin to, you know, be something that we could look at and really assess, you know, so I'm not saying it was a lapse, but you have the African American now, which is this third entity created out of these doubles.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you've created that third, you know, the sky's the limit. I mean, once you've ended the dualistic relationship, you know, you can have multiples, and it stops mattering to people's perception. You know, it's, you know, once you've broken mono, duo, once you've broken that, you're out. The world is wide open for you. One of the things that really has driven a lot of this work, being an African American from a middle class background, which, you know, is privilege, being able to go to colleges of my choice, you know, privilege, being a lighter skinned African American male, which, you know, at different times in history has been seen as privilege. In context of an art that oftentimes is defined by its struggle, at least among contemporaries. Like, I mean, you know, face it, I grew up in hip hop. So for me, when I turned my early 20s, was, you know, the whole Keep It Real thing happened pretty much when I was in college. Mm-hmm. So, you know, here I'm at Howard University, you know, in the middle of this extraordinarily economically depressed place, Washington, D.C., where the division between haves and have-nots was crystal clear. This began to formulate how I felt about myself, how I saw myself, what were my senses of responsibility, what did I owe, what did I feel I was owed.
Right.
You know, it wasn't purely a one-way street. What did I feel, how did I feel I was supposed to maneuver in this world? I grew up in a Lutheran church, which is fairly Norwegian and Republican, being one of the only families of color there and the only long-lasting family of color there. Huh. It just, you know, created very strange sort of understandings of the world. I remember right before I went to college, one of the older ladies in the choir actually said, "So I hear you're going to Howard." And I said, "Yes." And this is 1992. "I hear you're going to Howard, yes. Well, it's all Negro, isn't it?" And I said, all Negro. I was like, yeah. And she said, and she said this, and she said it in a way that I have to do my best to communicate the level of compassion with which she said this next thing. It was powerful. She said, "Well, you do realize it's a white man's world." Like, she was like, "Don't you know that if you go there, you're not, I mean, how are you going to function? I want you to be able to function. Don't go there." And so, you know, I had this moment, and, you know, my response to it was like, "Well, I'm still going to be in the world." You know? but that was one of the things that, you know, this was somebody that cared about me. Yeah. And this is how they voiced that concern and that care. Yeah. So being able to sit down and make the sort of sweeping rhetorical statements that I had been making earlier on in poetry, in my poetry, where, you know, if I'm talking about addiction, I'm saying, "Well, just don't do it, you know, and you'll be fine." Aha. I'm not only denying someone else's humanity, but I'm denying my own. And something that people will see in Fearsome is my own dealings with addiction, my own kind of issues with that sort of thing. And these are poems I would not have been able to write if I still felt like I had to have this sort of monolithic cultural experience that is denied in, you know, maliciously by racists, and is denied somewhat trying to be benign, you know, sometimes within the community, or it's like, you know, we have to be solid. We can still share, but we have these distinctions, we have these differences. And that's why I try to emphasize African-American experiences. Sure, there are similarities at different levels. There are parallels, you know, and this is not an attempt to distance myself from anybody. But when you go to someplace like Howard and you can see black kids that are studying opera and black kids that are, you know, freestyling in front, you begin to realize that the definition is wide. And when you're on your way, you're seeing black people that are struggling, you know, to pay rent, and all they're demanding is a little bit of courtesy and respect from these kids in leather jackets walking through their neighborhood to get to their school. I have friends that, you know, didn't have that respect and paid prices. Huh. You know, people demand respect. And so seeing that and understanding there are all these different experiences that had some links, but their differences had to be honored, or something that I tried to begin to do in my poetry. And as I became, and once I broke that, you know, "I'm rich, you're not, you know, I'm educated, you're not, I'm light, you're dark." Once I broke that, I realized, well, there's all of these things, all these shades of experience.
And on that note, I mean, I have to say, you do come from a kind of slam poetry background. You've done some amazing slam poetry, as far as I know, anyway.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I do spoken word. Yeah, slam is a specific. It's the act of the competition.
Yeah,
it's not something I do as much.
Spoken word poetry. Yeah. And even you said before, where you're doing that type of work, and you say, "This is the way it is.
Right.
It should be this way, and make it so." Versus, you know, the work that you've been doing for quite a while, that is more open to this kind of variation on themes, on experience, etc. Mm-hmm. And yet at the same time, it seems to preserve the type of performativity that kind of background, you know, could, the spoken word kind of, you know, coming from that type of writing, that type of poetry. Your work still very much preserves this kind of performativity. Obviously, we just heard you performing, you know, a bunch of poems. Mm-hmm. And what I find interesting, again, in that is that even when reading it on the page, like, you know, there's no Doug Kearney around, read it for me. Mm-hmm. I still get that.
Oh,
it,
good.
You know,
very
and,
good.
And I think that we've talked a bit about how it partially comes from the multiplicity of voices that you use, you know, even the forms that you use, the way that you set things up. But I don't know if you could talk to us a little bit about this kind of how do you relate the performativity of actually reading to actually the performativity, you know, on the page?
Oh, excellent question. I had the opportunity to study at Cave Canem, which is a poetry workshop slash retreat for African Americans. It was started in, like, I think 1996 by Toy Derricott and Cornelius Eady. I had the opportunity to study with Tim Siebels, who is one of my favorite poets. And I had written a poem that was, you know, scattered across the page. Like, you know, I'd broken a word here and way over there and, you know, stuff like that. And he said, and we had to read our poems before we workshopped them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I read the poem, but I read it, you know, fairly straight, as if it were all kind of left aligned and just straight down. And he said, well, if you're not going to honor the space on the page with how you, you know, with how you read it, then why do the space on the page? This I found to be, you know, usually you think about it the other way. It doesn't all have to be left aligned. But he was actually saying, you know, don't do anything without there being some sort of reason behind it. And if you're not going to honor it yourself, then, you know, what are you, you know, why should anybody else honor it?
Sure.
So that really put me in mind to really work with the page. Even before that, which led to the kind of scattered around the page, I had a poem about breakdancing called B-Boy Battle Behind Sunrise Liquor Store. And a good friend of mine, Yona Harvey, who's pretty much been like my, he's like my auntie, has ushered me through poetry and gotten me to different steps. You know, we're of an age, but still, I always felt like she was like ahead and, like, you know, she's really helped me. She's got this great poem about breakdancing and this language in the poem, but it's just like left the line because I had always been performing the work. So to me, it wasn't about anybody else's visual experience. It was, what's the easiest thing for me to read in a half-lit room that I'm going to be yelling and spitting at people while I do it? And so when she told me, you know, play with that, you know, see if you can make that happen on the page. See if you can make it dance on the page.
Yeah.
So I started doing that. And then Tim Siebels showed me, make it dance on the page when it's going to dance.
Right.
You know, but don't just make everything dance just for the hell of it. So that kind of level of performativity in the text became really interesting to me. When I first started doing spoken word, you know, I walked in. I was like, oh, man, you know, shoot, I want to see how I can make, because I knew even at that stage of it, I knew about the great tension between the page and the stage. You know, like the poets who are publishing in, you know, plowshares, you know, are true poets, and these, you know, performance poets are just kind of yelling at people. You know, there was that tension. There's that big argument. So my whole thing was like, well, you know, why can't you make work that works in both places? I'm sure I'm not the first person that thought of that or right. even thought they were doing that. And whether I was successful enough or not at that point, I don't know. But what I became interested in was, yeah, you know, melding. You look at the poem Atomic Buck Dance, though, and you're beginning to see this sort of thing of like, huh, well, how are they different? And ultimately, with any one of the reasons I like form is it gives you this sort of thing, and I'll use language that some people might not like, how to exploit it. You now know, well, how do I get the best out of this? So I began to say, well, like, if I'm just trying to find out what overlaps with performance and with reading, then I'm not getting the best out of each one. Now how can I find the tensions? And so I began to really look into how I can create tensions. How can I create visual puns so that the reader is getting a completely different experience than the listener? And I became very interested in that poetry's orality. You know, people like to say, well, poetry started off as an, you know, an oral form. And that's true, but that doesn't make the oral form better. It just makes, you know, historically it start off that way, you know, and, you know, now we have the written, you know, and so now people are saying that's what we're doing now, so it must be evolution. Well, that doesn't necessarily mean that either. Yeah. So how do you work both? If it can exist in both places, why would a person not wish to get the most out of it in both places? And so that became my interest in that. And the performativity, the sort of emotional energy behind it, a lot of that was a desire to not become really intellectually distant from what I was working on. I was always concerned that I would intellectualize things so much that the actual emotional quality would be taken from. That's something that people can latch onto as they're reading it. You know, I mean, during my time performing, I began to understand how audiences receive different kinds of performers, different types of performers. And I became, you know, I learned very quickly that an African-American male who came up and was angry was not, if he was trying to affect people, it was not effective. Because it was much like riding a roller coaster or watching a horror film. It's like, oh, scary, you know, angry black man. Woo, that was what I expected. Okay, good. You know, I can turn, you know, I've done that sort of thing now, you know. It's like a, you know, carnival. It's like for this sure. moment, this guy gets to stand in front of me and yell at me and be angry at me. And then everything gets back to normal where he's going to shut up when we're walking down the street because he can get knocked over the head if he spits at me. So I began to realize, well, I'm just playing that game if everything I do is yelling. And that became the sort of idea of nuance. How can and the pun and the idea of the trickster. How can I build my poems that would be Trojan horses? So they had to be attractive. They had to work in such a way that someone would understand and get a sort of a sense of an infectious sort of energy, but then realize, oh my God, you know, this is what I'm reading. And to be able to get it at a level that wasn't so much ideological, because ideology you can easily dismiss, but if you can, and it's the quest that I think a lot of poets are doing, trying to get to that bone, try to get to the bones, that when somebody reads it, they feel it there, they understand it there, and so any attempt to dismiss it, they have to deny a part of themselves in order to do that. And so it's sort of like, there's a Marvin Gaye song from his album, Hear My Dear, where the song is called You Can Leave, But It's Gonna Cost You. And so like it's sort of like that. Nice. You can exit this poem. The goal is you can exit this poem if you like and dismiss it, but you're going to have to lose something to do it. So what's worth more to you? So that idea of performativity, trying to make that same sort of infectious energy on the page as in the performance, is very important to me. It's not a kind of a tertiary concern. It's if it's not primary, it is secondary, that the poem is going to make somebody sit there and read it.
Uh-huh. And I would say, just for our listeners, that mm-hmm. Hearing you read a poem is absolutely a treat. Mm-hmm. And that even what you're just saying right now, but also reading the poem on the page is going to be an absolutely, not absolutely different experience, but it changes your reception of the poem. You notice different things, similarly like you saying the visual puns and et cetera. So. But I think we're going to take a quick break.
Okay.
And then we'll come back and read some more poems, talk a little bit more. And all
Excellent.
Right.
Thank you.